The Thunderbird pushed up against him like an affectionate pony. He scratched it from the nape of its neck up to the crown. Shadow turned to Easter. "You rode him here?"
"Yes," she said. "You can ride him back if he lets you."
"How do you ride him?"
"It's easy," she said, "if you don't fall. Like riding the lightning."
"Will I see you back there?"
She shook her head. "I'm done, honey," she told him. "You go do what you need to do. I'm tired." "Good luck."
Shadow nodded. "Whiskey Jack, I saw him. After I passed on, he came and found me. We drank beer together."
"Yes," she said. "I'm sure you did."
"Will I ever see you again?" asked Shadow. She looked at him with eyes the green of ripening corn. She said nothing. Then, abruptly, she shook her head.
"I doubt it," she said.
Shadow clambered awkwardly onto the Thunderbird's back. He felt like a mouse on the back of a hawk. There was an ozone taste in his mouth, metallic and blue. Something crackled. The Thunderbird extended its wings and began to flap them hard. As the ground fell away beneath him, Shadow clung on, his heart pounding in his chest like a wild thing. It was exactly like riding the lightning.
This ends Disc 16. American Gods, Disc 17.
Laura took the stick from the back seat of the car. She left Mr. Town in the front seat of the Ford Explorer, climbed out of the car, and walked through the rain to Rock City. The ticket office was closed. The door to the gift shop was not locked, and she walked through it, past the rock candy and the display of Sea Rock City birdhouses, into the eighth wonder of the world. Nobody challenged her, although she passed several men and women on the path in the rain. Many of them looked faintly artificial. Several of them were translucent. She walked across a swinging rope bridge. She passed the white deer gardens and pushed herself through the fat man's squeeze where the path ran between two rock walls. And in the end, she stepped over a chain with a sign on it telling her that this part of the attraction was closed, and she went into a cavern and she saw a man sitting on a plastic chair in front of a diorama of drunken gnomes. He was reading the Washington Post by the light of a small electric lantern. When he saw her, he folded the paper and placed it beneath his chair. He stood up, a tall man with close-cropped orange hair, in an expensive raincoat, and he gave her a small bow.
"I shall assume that Mr. Town is dead," he said. "Welcome, Spear Carrier."
"Thank you. I'm sorry about Mac," she said. "Were you friends?"
"Not at all. He should have kept himself alive if he wanted to keep his job, but you brought his stick."
He looked her up and down with eyes that glimmered like the orange embers of a dying fire.
"I am afraid you have the advantage of me. They call me Mr. World here at the top of the hill."
"I'm Shadow's wife."
"Of course. The lovely Laura," he said. "I should have recognized you. He had several photographs of you up above his bed in the cell that once we shared. And if you don't mind my saying so, you are looking lovelier than you have any right to look. Shouldn't you be further along on the whole road to rot and ruin business by now?"
"I was," she said simply. "But those women in the farm, they gave me water from their well."
An eyebrow raised.
"Ord's well? Surely not."
She pointed to herself. Her skin was pale, and her eye sockets were dark, but she was manifestly whole. If she was indeed a walking corpse, she was freshly dead.
"It won't last," said Mr. World. "The Norns gave you a little taste of the past. It'll dissolve into the present soon enough, and then those pretty blue eyes will roll out of their sockets and ooze down those pretty cheeks, which will by then, of course, no longer be so pretty. By the way, you have my stick. Can I have it, please?
He pulled out a pack of Lucky Strikes, took a cigarette, lit it with a disposable black Bic. She said, "Can I have one of those?"
"Sure. I'll give you a cigarette if you give me my stick."
"If you want it, it's worth more than just a cigarette." He said nothing. She said, "I want answers. I want to know things." He lit a cigarette and passed it to her. She took it and inhaled. Then she blinked.
"I can almost taste this one," she said. "I think maybe I can."
She smiled.
Nicotine.
"Yes," he said. "Why did you go to the women in the farmhouse?"
"Shadow told me to go to them," she said.
"He said to ask them for water."
"I wonder if he knew what it would do. Probably not. Still, that's the good thing about having him dead on his tree. I know where he is at all times now. He's off the board."
"You set up my husband," she said. "You set him up all the way, you people. He has a good heart, you know that?"
"Yes," said Mr. World, "I know. When this is all done with, I guess I'll sharpen a stick of mistletoe and go down to the ash tree and ram it through his eye. Now, my stick, please."
"Why do you want it?"
"It's a souvenir of this whole sorry mess," said Mr. World. "Don't worry, it's not mistletoe."
He flashed a grin.
"It symbolizes a spear. And in this sorry world, the symbol is the thing."
The noises from outside grew louder.
"Which side are you on?" she asked.
"It's not about sides," he told her. "But since you asked, I'm on the winning side. Always."
She nodded, and she did not let go of the stick. She turned away from him and looked out of the cavern door. Far below her, in the rocks, she could see something that glowed and pulsed. It wrapped itself around a thin, mauve-faced, bearded man who was beating at it with a squeegee stick, the kind of squeegee that people like him use to smear across car windshields at traffic lights. There was a scream, and they both disappeared from view.
"Okay, I'll give you the stick," she said.
Mr. World's voice came from behind her.
"Good girl," he said reassuringly, in a way that struck her as being both patronizing and indefinably male.
It made her skin crawl. She waited in the rock doorway until she could hear his breath in her ear. She had to wait until he got close enough. She had that much figured out. The ride was more than exhilarating. It was electric. They swept through the storm like jagged bolts of lightning, flashing from cloud to cloud. They moved like the thunder's roar, like the swell and rip of the hurricane. It was a crackling, impossible journey. There was no fear, only the power of the storm, unstoppable and all-consuming, and the joy of the flight. Shadow dug his fingers into the Thunderbird's feathers, feeling the static prickle on his skin. Blue sparks writhed across his hands like tiny snakes. Rain washed his face. "This is the best!" he shouted over the roar of the storm. As if it understood him, the bird began to rise higher. Every wing beat a clap of thunder, and it swooped and dove and tumbled through the dark clouds. "In my dream I was hunting you," said Shadow, his words ripped away by the wind. "In my dream I had to bring back a feather." "Yes," the word was a static crackle in the radio of his mind. "They came to us for feathers, to prove that they were men, and they came to us to cut the stones from our heads, to gift their dead with our lives." An image filled his mind then. Of a thunderbird, a female, he assumed, for her plumage was brown, not black, lying freshly dead on the side of a mountain. Beside it was a woman. She was breaking open its skull with a knob of flint. She picked through the wet shards of bone and the brains until she found a smooth, clear stone, the tawny color of garnet, opalescent fires flickering in its depths. Eagle stones, thought Shadow. She was going to take it to her infant son, dead these last 3 nights, and she would lay it on his cold breast. By the next sunrise, the boy would be alive and laughing, and the jewel would be gray and clouded, and as dead as the bird it had been stolen from. "I understand," he said to the bird. The bird threw back its head and crowed, and its cry was the thunder. The world beneath them flashed past in one strange dream. Laura adjusted her grip on the stick, and she waited for the man she knew as Mr. World to come to her. She was facing away from him, looking out at the storm and the dark green hills below. "In this sorry world," she thought, "the symbol is the thing. Yes." She felt his hand close softly onto her right shoulder. "Good," she thought. "He doesn't want to alarm me. He is scared that I will throw his stick out into the storm, that it will tumble down the mountainside and he will lose it." She leaned back just a little until she was touching his chest with her back. His left arm curved around her. It was an intimate gesture. His left hand was open in front of her. She closed both of her hands around the top of the stick, exhaled, concentrated. "Please, my stick," he said in her ears. "Yes," she said. "It's yours." And then, not knowing if it would mean anything, she said, "I dedicate this death to Shadow," and she stabbed the stick into her chest, just below the breastbone, felt it writhe and change in her hands as the stick became a spear. The boundary between sensation and pain had diffused since she had died. She felt the spearhead penetrate her chest, felt it push out through her back. A moment's resistance, she pushed harder, and the spear pushed into Mr. World. She could feel the warm breath of him on the cool skin of her neck as he wailed in hurt and surprise, impaled on the spear. She did not recognize the words he spoke, nor the language he said them in. She pushed the shaft of the spear further in, forcing it through her body, into and through his. She could feel his hot blood spurting onto her back. "Bitch," he said in English. "You fucking bitch." There was a wet, gurgling quality to his voice. She guessed that the blade of the spear must have sliced a lung. Mr. World was moving now, or trying to move, and every move he made rocked her, too. They were joined by the pole, impaled together like two fish on a single spear. He now had a knife in one hand, she saw, and he stabbed her chest and breasts randomly and wildly with the knife, unable to see what he was doing. She didn't care. What are knife cuts to a corpse? She brought her fist down hard on his waving wrist, and the knife went flying to the floor of the cavern. She kicked it away. And now he was crying and wailing. She could feel him pushing against her, his hands fumbling at her back, his hot tears on her neck. His blood was soaking her back, spurting down the back of her legs. "This must look so undignified," she said, in a dead whisper, not without a certain dark amusement. She felt Mr. World stumble behind her, and she stumbled too, and then she slipped in the blood, all of it his, that was puddling on the floor of the cave. And they both went down. The Thunderbird landed in the Rock City parking lot. Rain was falling in sheets. Shadow could barely see a dozen feet in front of his face. He let go of the Thunderbird's feathers and half slipped, half tumbled to the wet tarmac. Lightning flashed, and the bird was gone. Shadow climbed to his feet. The parking lot was three-quarters empty. Shadow started toward the entrance. He passed a brown Ford Explorer, parked against a rock wall. There was something deeply familiar about the car, and he glanced up at it curiously, noticing the man inside the car slumped over the steering wheel as if asleep. Shadow pulled open the driver's side door. He had last seen Mr. Towns standing outside the motel in the center of America. The expression on his face was one of surprise. His neck had been expertly broken. Shadow touched the man's face, still warm. Shadow could smell a scent on the air in the car. It was faint, like the perfume of someone who left a room years before. But Shadow would have known it anywhere. He slammed the door of the Explorer and made his way across the parking lot. As he walked, he felt a twinge in his side, a sharp, jabbing pain that lasted for only a second or less, and then it was gone. There was nobody selling tickets. He walked through the building and out into the gardens of Rock City. Thunder rumbled, and it rattled the branches of the trees and shook deep inside the huge rocks, and the rain fell with cold violence. It was late afternoon, but it was dark as night. A trail of lightning speared across the clouds, and Shadow wondered if that was the Thunderbird returning to its high crags, or just an atmospheric discharge, or whether the two ideas were, on some level, the same thing. And, of course, they were. That was the point, after all. Somewhere a man's voice called out. Shadow heard it. The only words he recognized, or thought he recognized, were, "To Odin!" Shadow hurried across Seven States Flag Court, the flagstones now running fast with rainwater. Once he slipped on the slick stone. There was a thick layer of cloud surrounding the mountain, and in the gloom and the storm beyond the courtyard, he could see no states at all. There was no sound. The place seemed utterly abandoned. He called out, and imagined he heard something answering. He walked toward the place from which he thought the sound had come. Nobody. Nothing. Just a chain marking the entrance to a cave as off-limits to guests. Shadow stepped over the chain. He looked around, peering into the darkness. His skin prickled. A voice from behind him, in the shadows, said very quietly, "You have never disappointed me." Shadow did not turn. "That's weird," he said. "I disappointed myself all the way. Every time." "Not at all," said the voice. "You did everything you were intended to do, and more. You took everybody's attention, so they never looked at the hand with the coin in it. It's called misdirection. And there's power in the sacrifice of a son. Power enough, and more than enough, to get the whole ball rolling. To tell the truth, I'm proud of you." "It was crooked," said Shadow. "All of it. None of it was for real. It was just a setup for a massacre." "Exactly," said Wednesday's voice from the shadows. "It was crooked. But it was the only game in town." "I want Laura," said Shadow. "I want Loki. Where are they?" There was only silence. A spray of rain gusted at him. Thunder rumbled somewhere close at hand. He walked further in. Loki Leismith sat on the ground with his back to a metal cage. Inside the cage, drunken pixies tended their still. He was covered with a blanket. Only his face showed, and his hands, white and long, came around the blanket. An electric lantern sat on a chair beside him. The lantern's batteries were close to failing, and the light it cast was faint and yellow. He looked pale, and he looked rough. His eyes were still fiery, and they glared at Shadow as he walked through the cavern. When Shadow was several paces from Loki, he stopped.
"You are too late," said Loki.
His voice was raspy and wet.
"I have thrown the spear. I have dedicated the battle. It has begun.
No shit, said Shadow.
No shit, said Loki. So, it does not matter what you do anymore.
Shadow stopped and thought, then he said, The spear you had to throw to kick off the battle, like the whole Uppsala thing, this is the battle you'll be feeding on, am I right? Silence. He could hear Loki breathing, a ghastly, rattling inhalation. I figured it out, said Shadow, kind of. I'm not sure when I figured it out, maybe when I was hanging on the tree. Maybe before, it was from something Wednesday said to me at Christmas. Loki just stared at him from the floor, saying nothing. It's just a two-man con, said Shadow, like the bishop with the diamond necklace and the cop who arrests him, like the guy with the fiddle and the guy who wants to buy the fiddle, two men who appear to be on opposite sides, playing the same game. Loki whispered,
You are ridiculous.
Why? I liked what you did at the motel. That was smart. You needed to be there to make sure that everything went according to plan. I saw you. I even realized who you were, and I still never twigged that you were there, Mr. World. Shadow raised his voice. You can come out, he said to the cavern. Wherever you are, show yourself. The wind howled in the opening of the cavern, and it drove a spray of rainwater in toward them. Shadow shivered. I'm tired of being played for a sucker, said Shadow. Just show yourself. Let me see you. There was a change in the shadows at the back of the cave. Something became more solid. Something shifted. You know too damn much, my boy, said Wednesday's familiar rumble. So they didn't kill you?
They killed me, said Wednesday from the shadows. None of this would have worked if they hadn't.
His voice was faint, not actually quiet, but there was a quality to it that made Shadow think of an old radio not quite tuned in to a distant station.
If I hadn't died for real, we could never have got them here, said Wednesday. Kali and the Morian, and the fucking Albanians, and, well, you've seen them all. It was my death that drew them all together. I was the sacrificial lamb.
No, said Shadow. You were the Judas goat. The wraith shape in the shadows swirled and shifted.
Not at all. That implies that I was betraying the old gods for the new, which was not what we were doing.
Not at all, whispered Loki.
I can see that, said Shadow. You two weren't betraying either side, you were betraying both sides.
I guess we were at that, said Wednesday.
He sounded pleased with himself.
You wanted a massacre. You needed a blood sacrifice. A sacrifice of gods.
The wind grew stronger. The howl across the cave door became a screech, as if of something immeasurably huge in pain.
And why the hell not? I've been trapped in this damned land for almost 1,200 years. My blood is thin. I'm hungry.
And you, too, feed on death, said Shadow.
He thought he could see Wednesday now. He was a shape made of darkness, who became more real only when Shadow looked away from him, taking shape in his peripheral vision.
I feed on death that is dedicated to me, said Wednesday.
Like my death on the tree, said Shadow.
That, said Wednesday, was special.
And do you also feed on death? Asked Shadow, looking at Loki. Loki shook his head wearily.
No, of course not, said Shadow. You feed on chaos.
Loki smiled at that, a brief, pained smile, and orange flames danced in his eyes and flickered like burning lace beneath his pale skin.
We couldn't have done it without you, said Wednesday, from the corner of Shadow's eye. I've been with so many women.
You needed a son, said Shadow. Wednesday's ghost voice echoed,
I needed you, my boy.
Yes, my own boy. I knew that you had been conceived, but your mother left the country. It took us so long to find you, and when we did find you, you were in prison. We needed to find out what made you tick, what buttons we could press to make you move. who you were. Loki looked momentarily pleased with himself. And you had a wife to go back home to. It was unfortunate, but not insurmountable.
She was no good for you, whispered Loki. You were better off without her.
If it could have been any other way, said Wednesday, and this time Shadow knew what he meant.
And if she'd had the grace to stay dead, panted Loki, wood and stone were good men. You were going to be allowed to escape when the train crossed the Dakotas.
Where is she? Asked Shadow. Loki reached a pale arm and pointed to the back of the cavern.
She went that-a-way, he said.
Then, without warning, he tipped forward, his body collapsing onto the rock floor. Shadow saw what the blanket had hidden from him, the pool of blood, the hole through Loki's back, the fawn raincoat soaked black with blood. What happened? He said. Loki said nothing. Shadow didn't think he would be saying anything any more.
Your wife happened to him, my boy, said Wednesday's distant voice.
He had become harder to see, as if he was fading back into the ether. But the battle will bring him back, as the battle will bring me back for good. I'm a ghost, and he's a corpse, but we've still won. The game was rigged.
Rigged games, said Shadow, remembering, are the easiest to beat.
There was no answer. Nothing moved in the shadows. Shadow said, goodbye. And then he said, father. But by then there was no trace of anybody else in the cavern. Nobody at all. Shadow walked back up to the Seven States flag court, but saw nobody and heard nothing but the crack and whip of the flags in the storm wind. There were no people with swords at the 1,000-ton balanced rock, no defenders of the swing-along bridge. He was alone. There was nothing to see. The place was deserted. It was an empty battlefield. No, not deserted. Not exactly. This was Rock City. It had been a place of awe and worship for thousands of years. Today, the millions of tourists who walked through the gardens and swung their way across the swing-along bridge had the same effect as water turning a million prayer wheels. Reality was thin here, and Shadow knew where the battle must be taking place. With that, he began to walk. He remembered how he had felt on the carousel, tried to feel like that. He remembered turning the Winnebago, shifting it at right angles to everything. He tried to capture that sensation. And then easily and perfectly, it happened. It was like pushing through a membrane, like plunging up from deep water into air. With one step, he had moved from the tourist path on the mountain to somewhere real. He was backstage. He was still on the top of a mountain. That much remained the same, but it was so much more than that. This mountaintop was the quintessence of place, the heart of things as they were. Compared to it, the lookout mountain he had left was a painting on a backdrop or a papier-mâché model seen on a TV screen, merely a representation of the thing, not the thing itself. This was the true place. The rock walls formed a natural amphitheater, paths of stone that wound around and across it, forming twisty natural bridges that eschered through and across the rock walls. And the sky was dark. It was lit, and the world beneath it was illuminated by a burning, greenish-white streak, brighter than the sun, which forked crazily across the sky from end to end, like a white rip in the darkened sky. It was lightning, Shadow realized. Lightning held in one frozen moment that stretched into forever. The light it cast was harsh and unforgiving. It washed out faces, hollowed eyes into dark pits. This was the moment of the storm.
The paradigms were shifting, he could feel it. The old world, a world of infinite vastness and illimitable resources and future, was being confronted by something else. A web of energy, of opinions, of gulfs. People believe, thought Shadow. It's what people do, they believe. And then they will not take responsibility for their beliefs. They conjure things and don't trust the conjurations. People populate the darkness with ghosts, with gods, with electrons, with tales. People imagine and people believe. And it is that belief, that rock-solid belief, that makes things happen. The mountaintop was an arena. He saw that immediately. And on each side of the arena, he could see them arrayed. They were too big. Everything was too big in that place. There were old gods in that place, gods with skins the brown of old mushrooms, the pink of chicken flesh, the yellow of autumn leaves. Some were crazy and some were sane. Shadow recognized the old gods. He'd met them already, or he'd met others like them. There were ifrits and piskies, giants and dwarfs. He saw the woman he had met in the darkened bedroom in Rhode Island, saw the writhing green snake coils of her hair. He saw Mama G from the carousel, and there was blood on her hands and a smile on her face. He knew them all. He recognized the new ones, too. There was somebody who had to be a railroad baron in an antique suit, his watch chain stretched across his vest. He had the air of one who had seen better days. His forehead twitched. There were the great gray gods of the airplanes, heirs to all the dreams of heavier-than-air travel. There were car gods there, a powerful, serious-faced contingent, with blood on their black gloves and on their chrome teeth. Recipients of human sacrifice on a scale undreamed of since the Aztecs. Even they looked uncomfortable. Worlds change. Others had faces of smudged phosphors. They glowed gently as if they existed in their own light. Shadow felt sorry for them all. There was an arrogance to the new ones. Shadow could see that. But there was also a fear. They were afraid that unless they kept pace with a changing world, unless they remade and redrew and rebuilt the world in their image, their time would already be over. Each side faced the other with bravery. To each side, the opposition were the demons, the monsters, the damned. Shadow could see an initial skirmish had taken place. There was already blood on the rocks. They were readying themselves for the real battle, for the real war. It was now or never, he thought. If he did not move now, it would be too late. In America, everything goes on forever, said a voice in the back of his head. The 1950s lasted for 1,000 years. You have all the time in the world. Shadow walked in something that was half stroll, half controlled stumble into the center of the arena. He could feel eyes on him, eyes and things that were not eyes. He shivered. The buffalo voice said, "You are doing just fine." Shadow thought, "Damn right. I came back from the dead this morning. After that, everything else should be a piece of cake." "You know," said Shadow, to the air, in a conversational voice, "this is not a war. This was never intended to be a war. And if any of you think this is a war, you are deluding yourselves." He heard grumbling noises from both sides. He had impressed nobody. "We are fighting for our survival," lowed a minotaur from one side of the arena. "We are fighting for our existence," shouted a mouth in a pillar of glittering smoke from the other. "This is a bad land for gods," said Shadow. As an opening statement, it wasn't Friends Roman's countrymen, but it would do. "You've probably all learned that in your own way. The old gods are ignored.
The new gods are as quickly taken up as they are abandoned, cast aside for the next big thing. Either you've been forgotten, or you're scared you're going to be rendered obsolete. Or maybe you're just getting tired of existing on the whim of people. The grumbles were fewer now. He had said something they agreed with. Now, while they were listening, he had to tell them the story. There was a god who came here from a far land, and whose power and influence waned as belief in him faded. He was a god who took his power from sacrifice and from death, and especially from war. The deaths of those who fell in war were dedicated to him, whole battlefields which had given him in the old country power and sustenance. Now he was old. He made his living as a grifter, working with another god from his pantheon, a god of chaos and deceit. Together they rooked the gullible. Together they took people for all they'd got. Somewhere in there, maybe 50 years ago, maybe 100, they put a plan into motion, a plan to create a reserve of power they could both tap into, something that would make them stronger than they had ever been. After all, what could be more powerful than a battlefield covered with dead gods? The game they played was called Let's You and Him Fight. Do you see? The battle you came here for isn't something that any of you can win or lose. The winning and the losing are unimportant to him, to them. What matters is that enough of you die. Each of you that falls in battle gives him power. Every one of you that dies feeds him. Do you understand? The roaring, whoomping sound of something catching fire echoed across the arena. Shadow looked to the place the noise came from. An enormous man, his skin the deep brown of mahogany, his chest naked, wearing a top hat, cigar sticking rakishly from his mouth, spoke in a voice as deep as the grave. Baron Samedi said, "Okay, but Odin, he died. At the peace talks. Motherfuckers killed him. He died. I know death. Nobody going to fool me about death." Shadow said, "Obviously, he had to die for real. He sacrificed his physical body to make this war happen. After the battle, he would have been more powerful than he had ever been." Somebody called, "Who are you?" I am his son." One of the new gods. Shadow suspected it was a drug from the way it smiled and spangled, said, "But Mr. World said..." "There was no Mr. World. There never was any such person. He was just another one of you bastards trying to feed on the chaos he created." They believed him, and he could see the hurt in their eyes. Shadow shook his head. "You know," he said, "I think I would rather be a man than a god. We don't need anyone to believe in us. We just keep going anyhow. It's what we do." There was silence in the high place. And then, with a shocking crack, the lightning bolt, frozen in the sky, crashed to the mountaintop, and the arena went entirely dark. They glowed, many of those presences, in the darkness. Shadow wondered if they were going to argue with him, to attack him, to try to kill him. He waited for some kind of response. And then Shadow realized that the lights were going out. The gods were leaving that place, first in handfuls and then by scores and finally in their hundreds. A spider the size of a Rottweiler scuttled heavily toward him on 7 legs. Its cluster of eyes glowed faintly. Shadow held his ground, although he felt slightly sick. When the spider got close enough, it said, in Mr. Nancy's voice, "That was a good job. Proud of you. You've done good, kid." "Thank you," said Shadow. "We should get you back. Too long in this place is going to mess you up." It rested one brown-haired spider leg on Shadow's shoulder. And, back on Seven States Flag Court, Mr. Nancy coughed.
His right hand rested on Shadow's shoulder. The rain had stopped. Mr. Nancy held his left hand across his side as if it hurt. Shadow asked if he was okay.
"I'm tough as old nails," said Mr. Nancy. "Tougher."
He did not sound happy. He sounded like an old man in pain. There were dozens of them, standing or sitting on the ground or on the benches. Some of them looked badly injured. Shadow could hear a rattling noise in the sky, approaching from the south. He looked at Mr. Nancy. "Helicopters?" Mr. Nancy nodded.
"Don't you worry about them, not any more. They'll just clean up the mess and leave."
"Got it." Shadow knew that there was one part of the mess he wanted to see for himself before it was cleaned up. He borrowed a flashlight from a gray-haired man who looked like a retired news anchor and began to hunt. He found Laura, stretched out on the ground in a side cavern beside a diorama of mining gnomes straight out of Snow White. The floor beneath her was sticky with blood. She was on her side, where Loki must have dropped her after he had pulled the spear out of them both. One of Laura's hands clutched her chest. She looked dreadfully vulnerable. She looked dead, but then Shadow was almost used to that by now. Shadow squatted beside her, and he touched her cheek with his hand, and he said her name. Her eyes opened, and she lifted her head and turned it until she was looking at him.
"Hello, puppy," she said.
Her voice was thin. "Hi, Laura. What happened here?"
"Nothing," she said. "Just stuff."
"Did they win?" "I stopped the battle they were trying to start."
"My clever puppy," she said. "That man, Mr. World, he said he was going to put a stick through your eye. I didn't like him at all."
"He's dead. You killed him, hon." She nodded. She said,
"That's good."
Her eyes closed. Shadow's hand found her cold hand, and he held it in his. In time, she opened her eyes again.
"Did you ever figure out how to bring me back from the dead?"
she asked. "I guess," he said. "I know one way, anyway."
"That's good," she said.
She squeezed his hand with her cold hand, and then she said,
"And the opposite? What about that?"
"The opposite?"
"Yes,"
she whispered.
"I think I must have earned it."
"I don't want to do that." She said nothing. She simply waited. Shadow said, "Okay." Then he took his hand from hers and put it to her neck. She said,
"That's my husband."
She said it proudly. "I love you, babes," said Shadow.
"Love you, puppy,"
she whispered. He closed his hand around the golden coin that hung around her neck. He tugged hard at the chain, which snapped easily. Then he took the gold coin between his finger and thumb and blew on it and opened his hand wide. The coin was gone. Her eyes were still open, but they did not move. He bent down then and kissed her gently on her cold cheek, but she did not respond. He didn't expect her to. Then he got up and walked out of the cavern to stare into the night. The storms had cleared. The air felt fresh and clean and new once more. Tomorrow, he had no doubt, would be one hell of a beautiful day. Part 4. Epilogue. Something that the dead are keeping back. Chapter 19.
One describes a tale best by telling the tale, you see? The way one describes a story to oneself or to the world is by telling the story. It is a balancing act, and it is a dream. The more accurate the map, the more it resembles the territory. The most accurate map possible would be the territory, and thus would be perfectly accurate and perfectly useless. The tale is the map, which is the territory. You must remember this.
From the Notebooks of Mr. Ibis. The two of them were in the VW bus, heading down to Florida on I-75. They'd been driving since dawn, or rather, Shadow had driven, and Mr. Nancy had sat up front in the passenger seat and from time to time, and with a pained expression on his face, offered to drive. Shadow always said no. "Are you happy?" asked Mr. Nancy suddenly. He had been staring at Shadow for several hours. Whenever Shadow glanced over to his right, Mr. Nancy was looking at him with his earth-brown eyes. "Not really," said Shadow. "But I'm not dead yet." "Huh?" "Call no man happy until he is dead." Herodotus. Mr. Nancy raised a white eyebrow, and he said, "I'm not dead yet, and mostly because I'm not dead yet. I'm happy as a clam boy." "The Herodotus thing, it doesn't mean that the dead are happy," said Shadow. "It means that you can't judge the shape of someone's life until it's over and done." "I don't even judge then," said Mr. Nancy. "And as for happiness, there's a lot of different kinds of happiness, just as there's a hell of a lot of different kinds of dead. Me, I'll just take what I can get when I can get it." Shadow changed the subject. "Those helicopters," he said, "the ones that took away the bodies and the injured, what about them? Who sent them? Where did they come from?" "You shouldn't worry yourself about that. They're like valkyries or buzzards. They come because they have to come."
"If you say so."
"The dead and the wounded will be taken care of. You ask me, old Jacquel's going to be very busy for the next month or so. Tell me something, Shadow Boy."
"Okay."
"You learn anything from all this?"
Shadow shrugged.
"I don't know. Most of what I learned on the tree I've already forgotten," he said. "I think I met some people, but I'm not certain of anything anymore. It's like one of those dreams that changes you. You keep some of the dream forever, and you know things down deep inside yourself because it happened to you, but when you go looking for details, they kind of just slip out of your head."
"Yeah,"
said Mr. Nancy. And then he said, grudgingly,
"You're not so dumb."
"Maybe not," said Shadow. "But I wish I could have kept more of what passed through my hands since I got out of prison. I was given so many things, and I lost them again."
"Maybe," said Mr. Nancy, "you kept more than you think."
"No," said Shadow. They crossed the border into Florida, and Shadow saw his first palm tree. He wondered if they'd planted it there on purpose, at the border, just so that you knew you were in Florida now. Mr. Nancy began to snore, and Shadow glanced over at him. The old man still looked very gray, and his breath was rasping. Shadow wondered, not for the first time, if he had sustained some kind of chest or lung injury in the fight. Nancy had refused any medical attention. Florida went on for longer than Shadow had imagined, and it was late by the time he pulled up outside a small, one-story wooden house, its windows tightly shuttered, on the outskirts of Fort Pierce. Nancy, who had directed him through the last 5 miles, invited him to stay the night. "I can get a room in a motel," said Shadow. "It's not a problem."
"You could do that, and I'd be hurt. Obviously I wouldn't say anything, but I'd be real hurt, real bad," said Mr. Nancy. "So you better stay here, and I'll make you a bed up on the couch."
Mr. Nancy unlocked the hurricane shutters and pulled open the windows. The house smelled musty and damp and a little sweet, as if it were haunted by the ghosts of long-dead cookies.
Shadow agreed reluctantly to stay the night there, just as he agreed even more reluctantly to walk with Mr. Nancy to the bar at the end of the road for just one late-night drink while the house aired out.
"Did you see Chernobog?"
asked Nancy, as they strolled through the muggy Floridian night. The air was alive with whirring palmetto bugs, and the ground crawled with creatures that scuttled and clicked. Mr. Nancy lit a cigarillo and coughed and choked on it. Still, he kept right on smoking. "He was gone when I came out of the cave."
"He will have headed home. He'll be waiting for you there, you know."
"Yes." They walked in silence to the end of the road. It wasn't much of a bar, but it was open.
"I'll buy the first beers," said Mr. Nancy.
"We're only having one beer, remember?" said Shadow.
"What are you?" asked Mr. Nancy. "Some kind of cheapskate?"
Mr. Nancy bought them their first beers, and Shadow bought the second round. He stared in horror as Mr. Nancy talked the barman into turning on the karaoke machine, and then watched in fascinated embarrassment as the old man belted his way through "What's New, Pussycat?" before crooning out a moving, tuneful version of "The Way You Look Tonight." He had a fine voice, and by the end the handful of people still in the bar were cheering and applauding him. When he came back to Shadow at the bar, he was looking brighter. The whites of his eyes were clear, and the gray pallor that had touched his skin was gone.
"Your turn," he said.
"Absolutely not," said Shadow. But Mr. Nancy had ordered more beers and was handing Shadow a stained printout of songs from which to choose.
"Just pick a song you know the words to."
"This is not funny," said Shadow. The world was beginning to swim a little, but he couldn't muster the energy to argue, and then Mr. Nancy was putting on the backing tapes to "Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood," and pushing, literally pushing, Shadow up onto the tiny makeshift stage at the end of the bar.
Shadow held the mic as if it was probably live, and then the backing music started, and he croaked out the initial "Baby." Nobody in the bar threw anything in his direction, and it felt good. "Can you understand me now?" His voice was rough but melodic, and rough suited the song just fine. "Sometimes I feel a little mad. Don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel?" And he was still singing it as they walked home through the busy Florida night, the old man and the young, stumbling and happy. "I'm just a soul whose intentions are good," he sang to the crabs and the spiders and the palmetto beetles and the lizards and the night. "Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood."
Mr. Nancy showed him to the couch. It was much smaller than Shadow, who decided to sleep on the floor. But by the time he had finished deciding to sleep on the floor, he was already fast asleep, half sitting, half lying on the tiny sofa. At first he didn't dream. There was just the comforting darkness. And then he saw a fire burning in the darkness, and he walked toward it.
"You did well,"
whispered the buffalo man without moving his lips.
"I don't know what I did," said Shadow.
"You made peace," said the buffalo man. "You took our words and made them your own. They never understood that they were here, and the people who worshipped them were here, because it suits us that they are here. But we can change our minds, and perhaps we will."
"Are you a god?" asked Shadow. The buffalo-headed man shook his head. Shadow thought for a moment that the creature was amused.
"I am the land," he said.
And if there was more to that dream, then Shadow didn't remember it. He heard something sizzling. His head was aching, and there was a pounding behind his eyes. Mr. Nancy was already cooking breakfast, a towering stack of pancakes, sizzling bacon, perfect eggs and coffee. He looked in the peak of health.
"My head hurts," said Shadow.
"You get a good breakfast inside you, you'll feel like a new man."
I'd rather feel like the same man, just with a different head, said Shadow.
Eat, said Mr. Nancy.
Shadow ate.
How do you feel now?
Like I've got a headache, only now I've got some food in my stomach and I think I'm going to throw up.
Come with me.
Beside the sofa, on which Shadow had spent the night, covered with an African blanket, was a trunk made of some dark wood, which looked like an undersized pirate chest. Mr. Nancy undid the padlock and opened the lid. Inside the trunk there were a number of boxes. Nancy rummaged among the boxes.
"It's an ancient African herbal remedy," he said. "It's made of ground willow bark, things like that."
"Like aspirin?"
"Yep," said Mr. Nancy. "Just like that."
From the bottom of the trunk he produced a giant economy-sized bottle of generic aspirin. He unscrewed the top and shook out a couple of white pills.
"Here."
"Nice trunk," said Shadow.
He took the bitter pills, swallowed them with a glass of water.
"My son sent it to me," said Mr. Nancy. "He's a good boy. I don't see him as much as I'd like."
"I miss Wednesday," said Shadow.
"Despite everything he did.
I keep expecting to see him, but I look up and he's not there."
He kept staring at the pirate trunk, trying to figure out what it reminded him of.
"You will lose many things. Do not lose this." Who said that?
"You miss him? After what he put you through? Put us all through?"
"Yes," said Shadow. "I guess I do."
"Do you think he'll be back?"
"I think," said Mr. Nancy, "that wherever two men are gathered together to sell a third man a $20 violin for $10,000, he will be there in spirit."
"Yes, but..."
"We should get back into the kitchen," said Mr. Nancy,
his expression becoming stony.
"Those pans won't wash themselves."
Mr. Nancy washed the pans and the dishes. Shadow dried them and put them away. Somewhere in there the headache began to ease. They went back into the sitting room. Shadow stared at the old trunk some more, willing himself to remember.
"If I don't go to see Chernobog," he said, "what would happen?"
"You'll see him," said Mr. Nancy flatly. "Maybe he'll find you. Or maybe he'll bring you to him, but one way or another you'll see him."
Shadow nodded. Something started to fall into place. A dream on the tree.
"Hey," he said, "is there a god with an elephant's head?"
"Ganesh. He's a Hindu god. He removes obstacles and makes journeys easier. Good cook, too."
Shadow looked up.
"It's in the trunk," he said.
I knew it was important, but I didn't know why. I thought maybe it meant the trunk of the tree, but he wasn't talking about that at all, was he?
Mr. Nancy frowned. "You lost me." "It's in the trunk," said Shadow.
He knew it was true. He did not know why it should be true, not quite, but of that he was completely certain. He got to his feet. "I gotta go," he said. "I'm sorry." Mr. Nancy raised an eyebrow.
"Why the hurry?"
"Because," said Shadow simply, "the ice is melting."
Chapter 20.
It's spring, and the goat-footed balloon man whistles far and wee.
E. E. Cummings.
Shadow drove the rental out of the forest. About 8:30 in the morning, came down the hill doing under 45 miles per hour, and entered the town of Lakeside, 3 weeks after he was certain he had left it for good. He drove through the city, surprised at how little it had changed in the last few weeks, which were a lifetime, and he parked halfway down the driveway that led to the lake. Then he got out of the car. There were no more ice-fishing huts on the frozen lake any longer, no SUVs, no men sitting at a fishing hole with a line and a 12-pack. The lake was dark. No longer covered with a blind white layer of snow, now there were reflective patches of water on the surface of the ice, and the water beneath the ice was black, and the ice itself was clear enough that the darkness beneath showed through. The sky was gray, but the icy lake was bleak and empty. almost empty. There was one car remaining on the ice, parked out on the frozen lake, almost beneath the bridge, so that anyone driving through the town, anyone crossing the town, couldn't help but see it. It was a dirty green in color, the sort of car that people abandon in parking lots. It had no engine. It was a symbol of a wager, waiting for the ice to become rotten enough and soft enough and dangerous enough to allow the lake to take it